Court is resumed.
Good morning, Justice. To begin our reply, I'm just going to briefly touch on one factual issue, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Harvey for the remainder of our reply. And the factual issue I was going to address relates to this discussion that came up in Canada's submissions regarding Chapter 3, which is not, which does not contain FATCA provisions in U.S. law, and the fact that there's a basis under that in relation to what's called the Qualified Intermediary Program to ask individuals about their U.S. status. So in my respectful submission, that discussion, to the extent it was meant to imply that the letters that are attached to lay witness affidavits and other similar letters would have been sent anyway or were being sent prior to the IGA, that is not the case, and that entire discussion of Chapter 3, at least insofar as that was the implication, is a red herring. And I'll explain why. The simple reason this is the case is because prior to the IGA, financial institutions were not required to confirm citizenship. And in fact, this is one of the concerns that financial institutions raise with respect to the IGA and with respect to FATCA, actually, in particular. And the reason I know that is because it's in the letter the banks sent to the government. So on that point, I'll turn the court, and this is the only document I'll turn the court to, it's in Volume 7 of the plaintiff's motion record. This is where Mr. Shum's affidavit is. Is it in the compendium? Oh, so I'm sorry, so we don't even need to go there. Tab 21 of the compendium. Tab 19. So it's page C186. So this is a letter from the Canadian Bankers Association to the Honorable Minister Flaherty, setting out some concerns that the Bankers Association has. It says it's heard from its constituents. And on the third full paragraph it says, FATCA raises a number of significant operational and public policy issues at an overarching policy level. The extraterritorial nature of FATCA is a serious concern, and Canadian banks do not feel that the burden imposed by FATCA is an appropriate one. Burden on them. Next paragraph. On a more granular level, the CBA has raised a number of concerns about this legislation with the IRS and Treasury, not the least of which is that Canadian banks typically do not collect information on citizenship, and Canadian law does not require that customers provide it in order to open an account. FATCA makes little allowance for the legislative and regulatory environments that govern Canadian retail banking. As a consequence, there are several elements of the legislation related to the identification of U.S. persons, the disclosure of personal information, and the opening and closing of accounts which simply do not reflect the operational realities of Canadian banks. They were not required to ask about citizenship before. So these letters asking to confirm citizenship, that's a new thing. And those witnesses who have exhibited those sorts of letters were not cross-examined as to whether or not they received those letters, those sorts of things before. So that's the main reply to that chapter 3 point. The other point I would make is that, and my friends took you through this, it only applies to U.S. source income. So to the extent there's a chapter 3 reason to know about somebody's citizenship.
So chapter 3 only applies to
U.S. It only applies, it's about U.S. source income, right? So it applies to a much narrower range of accounts. I mean, BACA applies to checking accounts. And so does the IGA. But that, I mean, that's a secondary point. That, I mean, it's certainly, even if there had been a requirement to ask about citizenship in respect of, for Chapter 3 reasons, it wouldn't apply to nearly as many people. But really the main point is there was no such requirement, and they weren't asking before. So these are BACA letters. So that's the only factual point I was going to address when I turned over to start with.
There's a power button on and off on the switch on that. Oh, on the square.
Sorry. I'm on. Oh, sorry.
Testing.
Oh. Justice Montano, I'm going to start with the issue of standing. Private interest standing is where a person is essentially directly affected by European legislation, and both of the plaintiffs being U.S. persons put their banking accounts automatically at risk of being disclosed now or in the future, and it seems to me that that's simply enough to constitute private interest standing. Excuse me. Think that it's actually, before I get to public interest standing, the plaintiffs with private interest standing have a right to seek a declaration from the court pursuant to Section 52 of the Constitution Act that the law is of no force and effect. And if I can take you to the Ferguson decision, which is in the it's in the reply record of the plaintiffs, volume 11, tab 98.
It's going to take me a minute.
Paragraph 59 of Ferguson says, when a law produces an unconstitutional effect, the usual remedy lies under Section 52.1, which provides that the law is of no force and effect to the extent that it is inconsistent with the Charter. And skipping down after the cites, Section 52 does not create a personal remedy. A claimant who otherwise has standing can generally seek a declaration of invalidity under Section 52 on the grounds that a law has unconstitutional effects, either in his own case or on third parties. And the courts have, so that would mean that if either or both of the plaintiffs have standing and they can argue why the law is unconstitutional by looking at its various applications to people who are subject to the law. Now, sometimes a plaintiff will call evidence of those persons. Other times, counsel have been permitted to construct reasonable hypotheticals. Now, where...
So if I stop you there, I know that's true for Section 12
of
the Charter. I've looked at the issue, and I know that's true. Is it... But I thought that was something that may have been particular to Section 12, or is it true for all the Charter sections?
Well, that's exactly where I was going next. It's definitely true for Section 12, and the reason it makes perfect sense in the context of Section 12 is those are usually in the context of mandatory minimum sentences. So the law says, you know, for this crime you're going to go to jail for 2 years, and then the courts, and Ferguson is one of the cases, and there's been many others, the courts have said, well, in order to determine whether this law imposes cruel or unusual treatment and punishment, you're allowed to conjure up hypotheticals, because the courts have said, if there's any hypothetical that will suggest that the law constitutes cruel and unusual treatment and punishment, we'll just strike down the law, even on the basis of hypotheticals. You don't really need a hypothetical in this case. In the blue book, the small blue book, which is the plaintiff's supplemental submission book, I took an excerpt of a recent decision on the Supreme Court of Canada called Boudreau. And it's a recent case about victim surcharges.
Which tab?
It's tab 3. And it's just a small excerpt that I thought was really useful as trying to kind of clarify the use of the word hypotheticals. And Justice Martin, I think was the author of this, said that sometimes hypotheticals are a misnomer. And I think to some extent we may have contributed to that confusion in our argument. She says in paragraph 55, she says, without a doubt, offenders with some or all of these characteristics appear with staggering regularity in our provincial courts. And then she was referring above to the evidence of the actual appellants and one of their witnesses, who was described as a reasonable hypothetical offender, Mr. Michael. He said they all live in serious poverty, they all have precarious housing situations, they all struggle with addiction. In addition, Mr. LaRocque, Mr. Michael grew up under child protection, have physical disabilities. Mr. Michael is indigenous. But then she says, the reasonable hypothetical offender urged on this court is Mr. Michael. Not a fabrication, but a real person. And that's fair enough. It's the next sentence I think is more helpful. In some other cases, the hypotheticals proposed are not living examples, but are the products of reasonably foreseeable applications of the law, of analyzing who might suffer what consequences as a result of a challenge provision. And I think that's the operative doctrine here. You don't have to refer to hypotheticals, you just look at the law and you see to whom it all applies to. And it applies to people with low value accounts and lower value accounts and high value accounts. It indicates what information has to be disclosed by those people to the to the banks. It indicates what information has to be disclosed by the banks to the CRA. It indicates what the CRA has to do with to the IRS. To some extent, you know, we focused a lot in this case on, you know, the poor little old lady or guy who's upset about their accounts. But, you know, our constitutional challenge applies to people who have wealth as well, and who will have high value accounts, but will have no tax liability to the United States. And so when you're considering your judgment, you're entitled to consider the application of this legislation to people to whom it applies, even though they're not before the court. And I think that's what Ferguson allows you to do. You know, in terms of public interest standing, well, again, the Downtown East Side case is now the definitive decision, and it was quite a breakthrough in the law of public interest standing. And that's found in our reply record of the volume 11, reply record of the plaintiffs at tab 93. In the past, there was a three-part test. If you go to paragraph 37 of the decision.
I'm sorry, which paragraph?
Paragraph 37 of tab 93.
Yeah.
This is the test now. Whether there's a serious justiciable issue raised, whether the plaintiff has a real stake or a genuine interest in it, and whether in all the circumstances the proposed suit is a reasonable and effective way to bring the issue before the court. Well, there's no question that the plaintiff has a, or this case raises a serious justiciable issue. We wouldn't be here for a week if it didn't. And that the plaintiff does have a real stake. She's clearly carrying the torch for what she considers to be the million Canadians or so who are designated as U.S. persons in Canada and who are affected by this decision.
Where does the 1 million figure come from?
Pardon me?
The 1 million figure come from? I'm not
I think
sure.
In Professor Christian's report, her first report. I don't think that's controversial. Nor there's a controversial that in the last couple of years, 500,000 or 600,000 reports have been shared by the CRA with the IRS. And the third category is whether in all the circumstances the proposed suit is a reasonable and effective way to bring the issue before the court. You know, the law before the Downtown East Side case was that there had to be no other reasonable way. And so as long as you could show that there were other people possibly more directly affected to bring the case, your public interest standing would be denied. The court made a very significant change to the test. Rather than saying, you know, are there other reasonable ways, the question is this a reasonable way? And I think it's obvious to say that this has been not just a reasonable way, but a reasonably effective way to have this issue brought before the court. Quite frankly, I don't hear Ms. Nygaard pushing back very hard on public interest standing. She acknowledges that the court has a discretion. The court, I think, has made comments to the effect that it would be a colossal waste of time if we had to start all over again with a different plaintiff, and to what end. The only point that Ms. Nygaard seemed to be concerned about was remedy. She says the plaintiff has public interest, and by the way, Ms. The plaintiff, Kazia Heighton, her husband swore an affidavit. Her documents that reveal that she has, where her accounts, what category her accounts would fall into, she has $50,000 or more in her accounts. The documents are all on the record. And the and Ms. Heighton was cross-examined or discovered by the defendant. So to suggest that she's sort of a non-entity in this litigation, I think, is wrong and unfair.
Sorry, was it written interrogatories like I saw for somebody else, or was there an oral examination?
There was oral examination. I don't think that those have been read into the record by my friend, but the documents are in the, her documents are on the record. And again, I'll perhaps let Mr. Arden speak to this because he knows it better, but my understanding is those documents reveal that she would have an account that would be a disclosable account because their bank balance would be in excess of $50,000. So as I said, Ms. Nygaard seems to be more concerned about remedy, and she says, well, the plaintiffs can get a Section 52 remedy, whether as private interest or public interest plaintiffs, but she says that public interest plaintiffs can't get a Section 24 remedy. And she said, I don't know whether Mr. Arden is even seeking a Section 24 remedy, but he has pled one in his notice of motion, which is true. Let me say this, and I don't have all the cases, but I don't think it's actually something that you're going to have to be too troubled by. There is sort of evolving jurisprudence on the issue about whether public interest organizations who have public interest standing can seek Section 24 remedy, either for the members of their organization or even for persons who not are members of the organization. And so the issue has arisen in British Columbia, at least, in the context of groups bringing remedies on behalf of homeless people, and the courts seem to be leading in the direction that even if the organization is not composed of homeless people, that they nevertheless might be able to seek a Section 24 remedy for them. Most of those cases have been sort of dealt with on motions to strike, and the courts have said, to the extent that public interest organizations seek 24 remedies, they're not doomed to fail. I don't think that there's been a definitive ruling on that point yet. Although, again, parenthetically, I can tell you that in the Carter case, the case involving assisted suicide, when the government sought an extension of the right order that the declaration of invalidity should be extended another 6 months, the Supreme Court of Canada allowed the extension for 4 months, not 6 months, but in the meantime, at the behest only of the BC Civil Liberties Association, because there were no longer any private plaintiffs in that case, the court ordered that anybody in Canada could seek a constitutional exemption allowing access to physician-assisted suicide or dying during the period of the suspension. A constitutional exemption is a Section 24 remedy. It was given at the behest of the BC Civil Liberties Association. So I say that to you, not that you necessarily have to worry about it, I don't think you do, because of this simple point. The only place I think that we would need something other than a Section 52 remedy is on the point that the CRA has admitted, you'll remember the cross-examination of Ms. Murray, has admitted that they are using the information that they obtained from the banks pursuant to the IGA, and they are putting it in their own data banks, and they are now using it, or feel free to use it, for domestic tax compliance purposes. And we say that is an unlawful, that's unlawful conduct by the CRA. I had suggested that that unlawful conduct may be attributed to the legislation, and therefore, if you accept that, that you would give the Section 52 remedy. And if you give a Section 52 remedy, for whatever reason, striking down the legislation, then it's for the courts to rewrite it. It's not for you to rethink
it. It's for the legislature to rewrite it.
Pardon me?
You said it's for the courts to rewrite it.
I'm sorry.
It's for Parliament.
It's for Parliament to rewrite it. Right. If, on the other hand, you come to the conclusion what the CRA is doing is unlawful, but it's not because of the law, but because of the conduct of the people, the administrators, the bureaucrats, then two things flow from that. Because it's not caused by the law, there's no Section 1 defense for it, because it's not prescribed by law, which is the opening threshold requirement for the government even to rely on Section 1. And secondly, because it's not caused by or prescribed by law, there still needs to be a remedy, but I don't need a Section 24 remedy. Section 24 remedy is only when, as my friend says, there has to be a person's rights or freedoms infringed. You could say the wholesale violation by CRA of Canadians' information violates the rights or freedoms of an indeterminate number of Canadians. I say you could say that relying on and reference Section 24. But I don't think you need necessarily Section 24. Federal court, as my friends have pointed out, is a court of superior jurisdiction. You always have the power to issue declarations that and the executive, the administration, are acting unlawfully. You don't have to say that, and that therefore someone's entitled to a Section 24 remedy. You can just simply say this conduct of SCR is not in any way authorized by law. It's inconsistent with the rights and freedoms in Section 8 or Section 15 of the Charter, and just declare it. So you can do that, or you can rely on Section 24, or you can rely on Section 52.
But you're asking for a Section 52 remedy in any event, so
that definitely is our primary remedy that we're seeking. And there's no question that individuals can seek public interest remedies. I think Mr. Thorson, the first standing case, where he wanted official language. Well, was that the flag case? Forget now. But anyway, I mean, he wasn't personally affected, and it was just the person, and he. Standing. Even in the downtown East Side case, there was a former sex worker who was the co-plaintiff, and her name is Ms. Kisselback, and the court granted both her and the association public interest standing.
We haven't discussed Typically, in these cases, if you do declare the law to be of no force in effect, the court suspends the operation of its order for a period to allow the government to get its house in order. We haven't discussed that at all. What do you say about that?
Yeah, well, the courts have granted those suspensions more readily than some of us think that the court should be doing. It started off, it needed to ensure that the rule of law prevailed. That was in the Manitoba language case. In other cases, it was to ensure that, you know, if there was no law, that there might be some sort of crises. The courts have been more ready to allow laws that they declare to be of no force in effect to be suspended for a period of time to give Parliament an opportunity to address it. Quite frankly, in this case, I think it would be appropriate because from much of the argument that you've heard, it may well be that Canada needs time to go back to negotiate with the Americans, and to have a judgment of this court in hand will be of great assistance to Canada, and I think we need to give Canada some time. As to the length of time, I would suggest 6 months, but after my friend will ask for a little bit more.
My understanding, and I'm going to let Ms. Nygaard reply to this because this is coming from me, nobody's discussed it, but my understanding is typically a year. I know in refugee health care, even 4 months because people's lives were at stake. I think I'd have to go back, and I'm pretty sure that's why it was a very short period of time, but typically it's at least a year.
Here's the problem with the typical year, in my experience. Government gets a year, and then they show up on month 10 or 11 and say they need an extension. What have we been doing for the whole year? And they seem to take longer than they need to and just start working near the end of the term. So my suggestion, if you give them 6 months, they'll be back inevitably for an extension. But, and then the courts have said, and the BC Court of Appeal have just issued a very, very strong judgment in the context of the solitary confinement case, in which the court did grant the government of an extension, but then imposed some pretty strict required conditions on the extension in order to sort of balance the, on the one hand, the government's interest in trying to, you know, get a new law out, and on the other hand, to protect the rights, the constitutional rights of people whose rights have been suspended during that period of time. So my request is 6 months, and recognizing the reality that nothing ever seems to be get done in that first period of suspension. But too bad.
Okay, let me hear from Ms. Nygaard on this, if you don't mind, Mr. Harvey, and then we'll move back to you.
I have 3 points on the timing. One is I draw your attention back to the IGA, which requires Canada to give the U.S. a year's notice of termination of the agreement, which I think needs to be taken into account here. Two, in response to Mr. Arve's submission that Canada inevitably comes back at the last minute and asks for an extension, on those occasions when Canada does that, Canada very much has to justify what's happened during that time. And three, this is an election year, which necessarily means that there will be a period of time where certainly Parliament is not sitting and changes cannot be made. So with all of those things, and I don't actually have instructions on a specific amount of time, but I would say at least a year, particularly given we have to give a year's notice for termination of the IGA.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Parvey, back to you.
Yes, thank you. Oh, and you'll recall Martin's decision. That's in Do you recall Justice Martineau effectively recognized that this was public interest litigation because in his, at the end of his decision, which is found in my friend's record, volume 6 of 7, he said on conclusion at paragraph 77, he says, there shall be no costs. This is the case where, in view of the nature of the issues and the public interest involved in clarifying the scope of novel provisions affecting hundreds of thousands of Canadian citizens, no cost should be ordered against the losing parties. So. So, I wanted to start off with Canada saying, words to the effect a number of times, that there's nothing earth-shattering about the IGA and the law that implements it. And one thing we've heard an awful lot about from Canada in this week is the common reporting standard, as if that is a full answer to this constitutional case. And essentially they say the common reporting standard involves a grand sweep of information of with respect to thousands of unnamed people. What's the big deal? And in fact, they talk, look at just sort of the what's happening global. Automatic exchange agreements are just sort of the thing. And with the movement of capital and people, it just all makes sense. I have a number of problems with that. The first is, it sort of feels like Big Brother is here. Get over it. Nobody really has any privacy anymore. Facebook, all those other social media apps and devices and whatever. We live in a world in which privacy doesn't matter anymore. Well, I asked the court to categorically reject that. For the people I represent, privacy is still very, very important. The common reporting standard only came about in 2017. It didn't provide the basis for the IGA. It came after the IGA back then. But one thing that you may or may not know, I don't remember if anybody brought it to your attention, but the United States is not a party to the Common Reporting Standard. But there's over 100 countries that are. And for those 100 countries, the Common Reporting Standard makes sense because it only requires exchange of information of taxpayers who are resident in the requesting jurisdiction, but are not resident in the jurisdiction that has the information. They just have an offshore bank account. Now, one thing that's for sure the case is that the constitutionality of the common reporting standards is not before you. It was never pled. It came up in argument. And I guess there's an affidavit that I touch on it. But we're not here to defend or attack the common reporting standards. I had said to you that in those, even with respect to the common reporting standards, insofar as Canada was providing information of persons who are non-resident in Canada, that it doesn't involve any person in Canada's charter rights. Ms. Niagara called me on that, and I think she was correct. That's possible. It's possible that one can be a citizen of Canada, but be a resident in the UK. There are such persons who would be caught by the common reporting standards. And it's even possible that you could be a resident in both jurisdictions. But as I understand it, that's when the tie-breaking rules apply, and so only one jurisdiction. And I don't know the formula, again, that's not this case. Okay, so it is possible that the common reporting standards could raise charter issues, but they're not before you. I don't know how they all work. But I guess I can say that because they do represent the will of hundreds of countries, over 100 countries, and they're based on a taxation law that turns on the residents, maybe those common reporting standards might survive a charter challenge, even though the IGA doesn't. Because even though there are 100 IGAs around the world, none of those were the idea of all those countries. All those countries were required to enter into the IGA in order to avoid the full consequences of FATCA. So, when Canada says there's nothing earth-shattering about the IGA, they first refer to the common reporting standards. Secondly, they refer to Section 221 sub D of the Income Tax Act. And let's go to that. And that is in, I think, our blue book. Tab 1. Sub D is the provision that allows the minister, rather the governor and council, to make regulations, D, requiring any class of persons to make information returns respecting any class of information required in connection with assessments under this act. And as I understand it, this is where all your T1s and T4s and T5s come from, or the requirement for people to collect that information and put it on a T-form and then provide that to the taxpayer and provide it to the government. And so Canada says, well, when banks are required to fill in, collect information from their customers and put it on a T5 slip and give it to the CRA, that appears to be requiring the collection of not just hundreds of thousands, but probably millions of records of millions of Canadians. about their banking information. And the minister didn't need a warrant for that. So, what's the big deal with the IGA? Same thing. They didn't use the regulation power, but they could have. And I say they, if they had tried to use the regulation power to do what they did with the IGA, we would be attacking that regulation on precisely the same grounds that we're attacking this legislation. But you might say, well, why is that? Why would it be different than the T5s? Well, the difference with the T5s is that the T5s show what income the banks have paid their customers by way of interest or dividends. And that information is, of course, directly relevant to the taxpayer's obligation to pay tax on net income. Requiring the T5s may also assist in keeping the taxpayers honest, because, first of all, a lot of people wouldn't even know or have had a hard time figuring out what their interest is. So the T5s are a convenience for the taxpayer. And also, since the taxpayer knows the bank's going to be getting the T5s, the taxpayer fills out the T1 with that information. But it all goes to what's, the taxpayer has no reasonable expectation in privacy about the income he gets from his bank, at least vis-a-vis the CRA, because he knows that income, if it goes above a certain level, is taxable. So there's nothing about a T5 that offends any Section 8 right or expectation of privacy.
Because it's relevant to their tax obligations. But I anticipate that the NIGARD, had she an opportunity to reply, would be saying that Justice Martineau has already found this information is potentially relevant to their U.S. tax obligations.
I'm coming to that. But before I do, I was trying to imagine a scenario that would help the court understand the problem with the IGA rather than just looking at the IGA. I thought it might be helpful to come up with an analogy. And the analogy is to think about people working in what's referred to as the gig economy, the people who drive Uber, people who do all sorts of things that doesn't necessarily require any record keeping that would come to the attention of the income tax authorities in the normal course. And so let's suppose that the CRA was concerned that because of Uber, a lot of taxi drivers declared income on their income tax returns just might not be accurate.
Just might not,
just might not be accurate. the declared income. Because people who use Uber know that there's a lot of taxi drivers who are sort of doing double duty. And apparently, the way drivers in Uber get paid, it doesn't come to the attention of the authorities. It's a cash economy. But then the CRA thinks, you know, it's not just the taxi drivers and Ubers. There's a lot of people in this so-called gig economy. And when I Googled that last night, it said that 40% of U.S. workers are now independent contractors doing something in which there's much ability to have a cash business. I mean, even before that term came up, we all knew that plumbers and contractors and carpenters and people came around to work at your house would often say, just pay me in cash. Not a new phenomenon. But what if the CRA decides that it wants to go after all of that, what otherwise would be income? They could start with taxi drivers, they could go to plumbers, or they could just want to go after independent contractors, period. And they request the banks to require its customers to disclose whether they are independent contractors of one sort or another. They can specify taxi drivers, they can have a list of different kinds of contractors. And the banks to require the customer to disclose that that's their occupation. And then require the banks to disclose the bank balances, the bank, and the types of accounts of all persons who fall into that category, which is essentially what the IGAI does. It requires the disclosure of, in addition to income, the person's name and address, the bank account number, the type of account, such as whether it's a checking account, a savings account, a brokerage account, and the account balance or value. We don't require anybody in Canada to do that. Could the CRA make that request of the bank under section 231.2(1)? Answer, no, because that would be a massive, that's 231.2.1 is what individuals. Would the minister require a warrant for that? Absolutely. Because it would fall into the category of third-party requests of unnamed persons. Absolutely. Would a judge of the federal court grant such a warrant? And here I submit to you that I highly doubt that a judge would. The minister would say, well, the reason we need this information is, well, we admit that it's not going to tell us whether this person owes any income. knowing the bank account number and whether it's a checking or a savings account or a depository or brokerage account, that's not going to tell us whether the person owes any income, but it might tell us what he's buying and selling and what his lifestyle is. Because we're trying to find out whether this person has a lifestyle that maybe suggests that he's living on some other sources of income. We want to know what's in his bank balance, because if we see kind of a growing bank balance and yet on his T1s it looks like he's only claiming that he lives on $30,000 a year, there could be a sort of disconnect.
These are these net worth assessments. These are these net worth assessments that the CRA does. If your lifestyle doesn't accord with your income, they can
do that on an individual basis. Unless, exactly right, they can do a lifestyle audit on an individual basis. And I say a court is not going to let the CRA to do lifestyle audits on a massive basis, just on the basis of using these sort of bank accounts as the beginning of a forensic investigation, which is going to lead to first wherever it's going to go. I say a court wouldn't allow that. I think a court would say, you know what, we live in a country in which self-reporting of income has become a fundamental norm in our society. We trust our taxpayers. Yes, as the courts have said, sometimes, you know, that trust is misplaced on individual taxpayers. And when we have, you know, solid grounds to go after individual taxpayers, then that's what the warrant is for. We're not going to allow the CRA to start to go on a massive fishing expedition just because there's this suspicion in the air that there's people out there, independent contractors, who might not be disclosing every penny of their income. Now that's, I submit that a court wouldn't grant a warrant in that case. And I submit if the government council tried to issue a regulation to that effect, the regulation would be struck down on the same basis that a court wouldn't give a warrant. But obviously, hypothetical case. But the reason I think it's helpful is that's what this IGA is about. The IGA, and the legislation that implements it, requires everybody who is a U.S. person resident in Canada to disclose that information, that same information. That information is not going to, so let's get back, it's, you know, the bank account number doesn't tell you whether you owe income. The type of account, checking, savings, brokerage, it doesn't tell you whether you owe income, but it may tell you how you're conducting your affairs, your personal affairs, who you're writing checks to, getting checks from. The account balance and value, that's not going to tell you if you owe income. That's just about trying to sort of see if you're hiding money, you're hiding taxes somewhere. And so there might be an account balance in there of $50,000. They might think, oh, that suggests that person has more income than, but what if it was $50,000 that was deposited by a parent into a student's account to pay tuition that day? I mean, where does that all go? What are they going to do with the information? What they're going to do with the information is that they're going to start writing letters to the U.S. person in Canada saying, we have this information, and first of all, and then sort of match up whether they filed any tax form, and if they didn't, then they are going to start their forensic investigation on as many or as few people that they decide they want to go after. But the information that the IGA requires, the U.S. person to disclose, will not indicate whether a person has income, it will not disclose whether the person complied with the act, didn't comply with the act, or whether there's any tax owing or how much. It's information that is going to be used to try to, as a starting point, to try to do a more forensic investigation of those taxpayers that they choose are worthwhile pursuing. And as we can see from the evidence that was referred to the other day, they seem to be only, even though they could go after hundreds of thousands, they seem to be only going after people who are tax evaders. And yet we have this huge fishing expedition. I say we wouldn't allow that similar sort of approach in Canada, because we have this hunch that there are people out there, on a systemic way perhaps, not disclosing all their income. We wouldn't do that. And yet, that's what's happening here. It's a systemic sort of regime which is designed to allow the IRS to pursue those people that it decides are the big fish that it wants to go after. But in the meantime, under the rubric of this is just tax compliance, they somehow justify it. It may be under the rubric of tax compliance, and that's how Justice Martineau referred to it. But in my submission, and the evidence in this court supports, it is a massive fishing expedition designed to catch tax evaders. Do you really think the IRS is going to spend the resources required to be combing through the hundreds of thousands of returns each year to find out whether some little old lady owes, no disrespect to little old ladies.
Some of us are approaching that category. Be careful, Mr. Irving.
I'll go with little old men because I'm one. That they owe a few bucks? No way. There's no way. And though, so I come to Justice Martineau's comments. Justice Martin was deciding a case about whether the provisions of the IGA were consistent with the treaty. It was an ultra vires issue. It was a treaty interpretation issue. And he decidedly said it's not a charter case. Of course, it wasn't. And his decision is not in any way binding on this court, on anything this court has to do in deciding the charter.
Let me stop you there for a second.
Okay.
It's an unusual situation. It's not like a finding by one judge in the context of one case that this is the purpose of the legislation. It is a finding by a judge in this case. It's the same case. So, I mean, when we look at principles of stare decisis, it may not be binding on me from a stare decisis point of view, but can I come to a different conclusion than Justice Martineau? That's the first part of it. The second part of it is independent of that. Can you have different purposes depending on whether it's a vires question or a charter question?
Well, There's different evidence in this case, of course. But let me start this way. Canada's really only justification for seizing this, the financial information of hundreds of thousands of Canadians, only justification is that the United States asked it to do so if Canada, if the Canadian banks didn't want to be burdened directly by FATCA. In fact, the United States insisted, if you want to extricate your banks from direct compliance with FATCA, this is what you have to do. And this is the reason why Canada did it. Canada justified the legality of what it was doing before Justice Martineau on the basis that the treaty indicated that the parties will assist each other with tax compliance. Let's just go to the treaty, which my we put it in the blue book as well. And the reason I did that is and Mr. Taylor explained, if you go to the record in the motion book and you find the treaty and the treaty act, it's incorrect. and Mr. Taylor explained why, because of various protocols.
Right.
And so we put it as well in the blue book at tab 6. The relevant article is Article 27. Says the competent authorities, do you have it, Jesse?
Yep.
The competent authorities of the contracting party shall exchange such information as is relevant for carrying out the provisions of the convention or the domestic laws of the contracting states. I think that's all I need to read. And so the question is whether or not the information in the asked that was to be exchanged by virtue of the IGA was relevant to the domestic laws of the contracting states. And he, Justice Martineau said, I think that maybe what Mr. Nygaard read to you, paragraph So in paragraph 14, Justice Marno, it says the issue to be considered in the summary trial is normally whether the information exchanged is foreseeably relevant. And at the bottom of that paragraph, he says information that the CRA receives from treating partners assists the CRA with its offshore compliance work, risk assessment, workload development, trend analysis, and other matters relevant to ensuring compliance with Canada's tax laws. And then he says, and I'm sorry, I'm just trying to. I didn't make a note of the paragraphs that Ms. Nygaard wrote gave you earlier. I remember some of this. Did you take hard to find any specific place, but he says in 71, I accept that by analogy, factor reporting requirements are similar in principle to certain Canadian reporting requirements under the ITA that also do not require information indicating income tax or tax liability. For example, 233.3 requires certain taxpayers to report holdings of a wide range of foreign property with a cost of more than $100,000, regardless of whether or not property generates income that is taxable in Canada. These reporting requirements exist to assist the CRA in administering the Canadian tax system. It cannot be reasonably argued that similar kinds of information about U.S. taxpayers is not relevant to carrying the provisions of U.S. tax laws, irrespective of Canadian residents or U.S. persons. There may be other provisions of relevance. Of course, the one that I want to, you to keep in mind is also, insofar as he's dealing with FATCA, be that as it may, the stated purpose of FATCA is to improve U.S. tax compliance by obtaining information from foreign financial institutions about accounts made by U.S. taxpayers directly or through intermediary entities. The American authorities were particularly concerned in 2010 about tax evasion. Nevertheless, the statute should be interpreted by political statements used around should not be interpreted by politician statements used to rally public opinion, rather by its objects and words used by the legislature. Legally speaking, it is apparent FATCA has overreaching effects in practice. CRA officials have the same understanding with respect to the collection and reporting requirements created by the IGA of the ITA, which only mirror FATCA requirements. And so does this court, having examined the appeal provisions in light of the U.S. domestic law referred to by the experts in the various reports and answers to questions by counsel during the cross-examination. So that's what Justice Martineau decided. Now, If Canada's essential defense in this case is that the IGA provisions have a valid purpose, and indeed a purpose of such importance that would override any taxpayers' concern about privacy, or indeed justify the infringement of the Section 8 right, or Section 15 right, because the request was made pursuant to a treaty, then that can't be right. A treaty doesn't create sort of a charter-free zone. The fact that Canada could not in any way justify this law but for the treaty is, I think, is a very important point. And so if it is just because this request was made pursuant to the treaty, that makes it a constitutional law, suggests that all Parliament has to do to avoid the charter is make sure its laws implement some international treaty. And that's clearly not the law. In fact, I think the courts will look to treaties when they're deciding whether or not laws which infringe constitutional rights are, in the Section 1 analysis, in a free and democratic society, are there other countries that have similar treaties. But treaties can only ever provide the floor of one's constitutional rights, not the ceiling. A treaty may be a document that seems to enrich one's sort of rights and freedoms, and the courts will look to that as a way of, giving content to rights and freedoms. But I know of no case in which a treaty has ever been treated as the ceiling for one's rights and freedoms. The case that comes to mind was the Insight case, in which Canada argued that the treaty that it made with other countries dealing with narcotics would have forbidden something like Insight. That wasn't going to be enough to impede the plaintiff's case in that case. Treaties can be of some assistance to the court, as I said, in the area of the right to strike and collective bargaining, they were quite important to give content to the freedom of association, right? But I know of no case in which a court would say because Canada has done something pursuant to a treaty that somehow gives it a pass on the charter. So here, the most that Justice Martineau has done is to say that the IGA exchange, the IGA which called for this exchange of information, is consistent with the terms of the treaty that require parties to exchange information where it may be relevant to the other's tax scheme. The only reason the information in the IGA is relevant to the United States tax scheme is because they tax on the basis of citizenship. As I said in my earlier submissions, it's not for the court to rule on the validity of that U.S. law or the even the reasonableness of it, although Mr. Taylor indicated that it actually stems from the Civil War, American Civil War, where the U.S. expected its citizens, other parts of the world, to pay their share. I think that is the historical basis for the citizen-based taxation. That's something that Professors Christensen and Caulfield note in their piece. But that Civil War ended some time ago. What's the rationale today? Is the rationale today that Canadian citizens, the residents who happen to be U.S. citizens by birth, will have to continue to finance all the U.S. wars or walls? Doesn't Canada have some obligation in this court to explain why it was important to Canada to give effect to this citizen-based taxation law, given the encroachment into the privacy rights of Canadians that it causes? But we don't have any evidence from Canada as to why this purpose is important to Canada. It might be important to the United States, but why is it important to Canada? Imagine another scenario.
Let me stop you there, Mr. Harvey. How do those two things live together? On the one hand, it's not up to me to pass judgment on the appropriateness of the policy choices that have been made by the U.S. government vis-a-vis their citizenship-based taxation. That's their call. Isn't asking Canada to say why it's important to it really asking you to do through the back door what I can't do through the front door?
Well, imagine this not implausible scenario as a way to maybe help us work through this. And I confess this is difficult. Canada has agreed to assist the United States by providing information that may be relevant to their domestic tax laws. What if the United States amends their tax law to impose a special tax on U.S. persons wherever they are whose parents were born in China? And that the clear purpose of this tax or motive was political or economic or whatever dispute the United States government was having with China. Not a totally crazy idea. Would we uphold a Canadian law that required Canada to ferret out from Canadian banks whether their customers who are Canadian citizens and residents of Canada had parents who were born in China and pass that information to the CRA and give it to the United States? I don't think so. And so what's the difference? The court wouldn't be in a position to rule on the reasonableness of the U.S. law. They may have their reasons, political reasons, economic reasons, trade reasons. But we wouldn't give effect to it, because it wouldn't make any sense to Canada. It wouldn't be a purpose that makes any sense to Canada. And that's the problem with the citizen-based taxation. As I said in my opening, it's the root of the problem of this case. It seems to me, if a Canadian court was to say to Canada, look at, the Americans can do whatever they want with citizen-based taxation, and they've been doing it for 200 years, and it's never impacted the Canadian government or the Canadian people. And now they come along and they now want to extend the reach of this tax law into Canada. And yes, there's a treaty, and yes, I know you can do this under the treaty. And Justice Martineau says it's relevant under the treaty, but now we're in charter land. And now the court has to be satisfied that this is a purpose that Canada can justify in a court to support the reasonableness of the law or to justify the infringement. And Canada can't do that. There's no evidence. Canada makes no attempt to say this makes sense. And I say, if that means that Canada is not going to support citizen-based taxation in Canada, well then hooray for Canada. It's the courageous thing to do, Canada. If they won't do it on their own, they're going to need some help from this court.
Is there not a difference? I mean, your example of the taxing people whose parents came from China, I mean, on its face, it's discriminatory.
Sorry, say that one more time?
It's on its face a law that says we're going to impose an extra tax burden on people whose parents came from China.
Oh, yeah.
On its face, it's discriminatory.
On its face, it's?
Discriminatory. And?
Well, all right.
I mean, there's no rational connection between your, it's not like your income's over a threshold. It's purely your tax burden's tied to your national origin. Isn't that different from citizenship-based taxation? You may not like it, you may not agree with it, but surely it's open to a country to decide we're going to tax our own citizens, all of our citizens, not just a particular group of our citizens. We're going to tax all of our citizens wherever they may be in the world. I mean, it's fundamentally different, isn't it?
But if you say that the example I gave is discriminatory in Canadian terms or American terms, and if you're saying I don't think a Canadian court is going to determine that an American law violates their laws. I don't think you have jurisdiction to do that. So you would be saying, well, it seems like it's wrong from Canada's point of view. And that's right. I think you can do that. I'm not saying that we are saying that we are asking you to do exactly that with respect to citizens-based taxation insofar as it applies in Canada. It has no valid purpose in Canada and is both discriminatory for reasons I've explained and violates Section 8 rights for the reason I've explained. Canada just can't be asked to, just because it's in a treaty, to implement foreign laws without Canada having to justify that the implementation in Canada has some valid purpose. And you know, and we're just talking about this case, and and right now that's all I care about, and we don't need to sort of think about other cases, but Canada should be saying to itself, how does this law make any sense to Canada as a treaty partner with the United States when we, Canada, know that Canada is not a tax haven? We Canada know that there are going to be a fraction of U.S. persons in Canada who would have any tax liability at all. And that's because we have a treaty with the United States which prevents any sort of double taxation. And yes, there may be a smaller category of some persons who fall between the cracks, the so-called treaty gaps, but those are treaty gaps that both sides have and have known forever and have respected forever and have never tried to tax the other person's citizen or resident based on the treaty gaps. There's nothing about this law that makes any sense from the point of view of Canadian taxation law.
I'm having difficulty in understanding how a lot of this is proper reply, and particularly when it states things that are just incorrect. So, you know, for example, my friend just said, we've never taxed, neither of the countries has ever taxed based on the treaty gaps. That's entirely incorrect. If someone has a tax liability that isn't caught by, that falls into those treaty gaps, they have an obligation to file and they are taxed on that. So I don't need to do it now. There was one other thing that was just simply incorrect that I would like to correct. And I don't know if you'd like me to do that now or wait
for
Mr. Archer's finish.
Sure, while we're thinking of it.
And this was actually the point Mr. Beddoes made. And what he told you, and I'm sure it was unintentional, was simply incorrect when he said that this Chapter 3 reporting was never required prior to FATCA. And the easiest way for me to point that out to you is the exhibit to Mr. Heighton's affidavit that was passed up to you. And I won't make you find the piece of paper. I can, unless it's easy, but I can just tell you. It's the RBC Dominion Securities letter. Tab 12 of the compendium.
Yep.
Okay. If you look at the second paragraph of that letter, or sorry, the first paragraph, the bank says, I'm writing to inform you that your WABEN form, that's the Chapter 3 form, that you have filed with RBC Dominion Securities will expire on December 31st, 2016. This form is valid for 3 years. So the original form had been provided in 2013 prior to FATCA. And I mean, Professor Steins also speaks about this being a pre-FATCA thing that existed. So I just wanted to ensure that the court had the correct information.
Thank you. Mr. Arbe, it has occurred to me that some of your comments are a little beyond normal reply, so I don't know how much more you've got, but let's keep that in mind. I was keeping my eye on Ms. Nygaard, and she's been very restrained, but let's not push it too far.
Okay, I appreciate that. Just maybe to close off on what Justice Martineau did, and what you're permitted to do. He found that the IGA allows for the exchange of information that may be relevant in the sense that it may not only be used to find tax evaders, but may be used just to find out whether people are just complying, filling in their forms. But what you heard from me in this case, in the charter case, it was submissions and evidence that wasn't that important or not as important in an administrative law case. You've heard here that the fundamental or the main purpose or the primary purpose or the dominant purpose that the United States is, how they're using this information is to catch tax evaders. And I say that that's a fact, that's an important fact in the charter analysis for you to consider. And I won't repeat what I said last day, other than to remind you why I said it was a fishing expedition, even if it wasn't going just after the sharks, and I won't repeat that.
I'm just looking at the time, starting. How much longer have you got? I'm not.
I think we should probably take the, I didn't think I'd be this long, but I'm still going at it, so I think we should probably have a break.
Well, in fairness to our reporter,
sure. So,
have a break.
Order.
Court is adjourned for 15 minutes. Court is resumed.
So, Justice McTavish, you asked Ms. Nygaard whether FACTA, let me back up for a minute. Ms. Nygaard said to you that this court can't really second guess whether Canada could have got a better deal, because she says that would have required the agreement of another party. We didn't have the agreement of the other party. I don't know if she was saying that therefore that's not a justiciable question. It sort of sounded like she was saying you can't ask Canada to have to persuade this court, even though we have the onus under Section 1, that we could have got a better deal. And therefore, Ms. Nygaard said, the only thing the court needs to be concerned about is that FATCA is the default. And if FATCA as the default is worse than the IGA, then as I understand, my friend, that's the end of the story. I think I fairly stated her position.
I don't see her jumping up.
Head was not nodding. So let's look at that a little more carefully. Mr. Oshinsky, who she referred to at some length, was asked to consider two scenarios, really only two scenarios, total compliance with FATCA and total noncompliance. She also said, and I say this parenthetically, I believe I heard her say that Parliament didn't have anything like the Oshinsky report. The court has it. In fact, I don't think there's really much, if anything, in the record as to what Parliament had that would have supported counsel's assertion in their legal argument that the IGA was necessary to avoid a, in her words, a financial catastrophe. I don't think we can say that Parliament's objective was to avoid a financial catastrophe. Parliament's objective may have been to avoid FATCA. Essentially, that's what I think my friend is saying you should look at.
Would
I don't know what went on in the discovery process. It's not an application for judicial review, so you don't get the record. And in any event, it would seem to me that at least some of the information on which Parliament based its decision would be subject to cabinet confidence type privilege.
Right.
So where does that take us?
Well, I guess that takes us back to what I said at the outset, that if the government is relying on a defense which is so cloaked in privilege or in matters of that it could never disclose to the court, that it doesn't seem right that the court can take notice of that defense because the plaintiffs aren't in a position to test it. And I hope I haven't misheard or mischaracterized my friend's defense, but it seems to me to be the justiciable issue, she says, that the court can take notice of, is that FATCA was worse than the IGA. And she said that a number of times. She says the court can't ask counsel the court can't second guess the government on whether they could have got a better deal, because there was only two choices, FATCA or no FATCA. So it seems to me it puts enormous pressure on Canada to persuade this court, and it is Canada's defense, that FATCA was truly worse than the IGA. And I say, looking at the evidence, that they're not going to be able to discharge that onus for these reasons. If you go to Mr. Oshinsky's report, which is found at tab 26 of the compendium, we know that he considers the financial and economic impacts of non-compliance to be very serious. And he says that at pages C, bottom of C, 383 and over to C, 384. I'm not going to read that. You've seen that. He's got low numbers, high numbers. Apparently he's confident in his low numbers. They're still big numbers. I'm assuming that the low number of $1 billion is a year and not entirely, but I don't see the word he said about it. In any event, I'm assuming that, for the sake of this discussion, total non-compliance would have serious economic consequences. But what he says about compliance is much more important. He says, for compliance on page CA3, likely economic impacts. He says, impacts on all economic variables is expected to be insignificant. Now, all the evidence in the record, Mr. Beddoes took you through it, I think my friends took you through some of it, is that the banks intended to comply. They were getting ready to comply. The banks didn't have any problems with compliance other than they were concerned about the bank secrecy laws and the bank access laws. That was their concern. They had administrative concerns about having to deal with withholding, but it wasn't, if they were going to comply, it wasn't, compliance with FATCA wasn't going to hurt the banks. But they were concerned about those other variables. So compliance with FACTA was only going to be an issue for the customers. But here's what I want to sort of get to, and then I'll develop it. What FATCA did was allowed the customers on a customer-by-customer basis to decide whether or not to waive any privacy concerns in their banking information. Under FATCA, it was up to the customer, customer-by-customer, to make a choice whether or not to disclose, whether or not to allow the banks to disclose their banking information.
Sorry, how does that work? I thought under FATCA, the banks, assuming they're going to comply, they disclose.
It would be up to the customer. Under FATCA, the customer would be asked to whether or not he or she was prepared to, because if the banks were complying, then the banks then were obligated to ask the customers for the for their permission to disclose their information to the IRS. If the customer, I see my friend perching.
And my only point, Justice, is I fail to see how this is proper reply.
Well, it's completely proper reply because I'm responding to her emphasis a number of times that the only thing you consider is whether FATCA is worse or better. That's why it's proper reply. And if you and I think I can demonstrate to you that FATCA was better, at least from the perspective of the customers who have individual rights to decide, rather the IGA or the government took that right away from them.
Reply is intended to address issues that the party could not anticipate were going to arise that arise during argument. It's always been Canada's position. It's always been very clear that Canada's position was that FATCA would be worse than the IGA. That was not a surprise to my friend. It should, if it was something he needed to address, it's not something he should have been giving to a reply.
I'm mindful of your concern, Ms. Nygaard. I think I'm going to hear from Mr. Arve and I'll decide what to do.
Thank you. So when the customer went in to a bank that's been complying, the customer may be asked to disclose to the United States that they are U.S. persons and their banking information. Some customers will say, okay, either because the customers don't have privacy concerns. Some customers may say okay, because the bank will tell them if you don't give us this information, we're required to withhold from your account 30% of your U.S. source income. And some customers may say, "Oh, my privacy is not worth that much to me. Give them the information." Other customers may say, no, I'm not going to give you that information, and I'm going to go look elsewhere to bank, such as, even under FATCA, there were some exempt banks or credit unions. Others may not consent. And one reason being they don't have any U.S. source income. So they're not worried about the U.S. 30% withholding tax on them. And so not consenting wouldn't have any consequences to them wherever they bank. There might be some customers who do have U.S. source income, and they were nonetheless still not prepared to consent, but were prepared to accept the consequences of the 30% withholding tax. Because as I think Mr. Oshinsky even pointed out, there's a possibility of getting a portion of that refunded. Maybe not a high likelihood, I think he said, but a possibility. Now, for those customers in countries such as Canada, which have bank secrecy laws, Mr. Wood, in his evidence, has said the bank wouldn't be required to close the customer's account. Now, take you to his evidence at tab 3. He says at compendium tab 3, page C18D. Oh no, sorry. C18B.
B or D?
B is in Peter. Peter. B is in Bob. He says here, the second paragraph from the bottom, if the foreign financial institution is located in a jurisdiction with bank secrecy laws, the institution must seek a waiver of those bank secrecy laws from the account holder. U.S. persons or suspected U.S. persons who cannot establish that they are not U.S. persons or who do not agree to a waiver can be deemed recalcitrant account holders. The foreign financial institution is authorized by U.S. law to shift the withholding obligation to parties who transfer the funds to recalcitrant account holders rather than being subjected to withholding obligations themselves. And so, if the customer continues to want to be subject to that withholding, that doesn't mean they couldn't bank there. Perhaps more likely, customers would search out other banks, and more likely as well, a market would develop for those banks, for those people who want to be free of FATCA. Now, the big banks might not like that. They want to keep all the customers. They don't want to lose customers.
So what banks would they go to without the IGA? It's the IGA that exempts certain banks.
Well, I think FATCA exempts certain banks too, but the IGA just exempted more.
Better help me with that, because I'm not aware of that.
Right. As my colleague reminded me, they would go to those banks which themselves don't have U.S. investments. So,
which banks are now?
Pardon?
Are there banks in Canada that don't have Are there banks in Canada that don't have U.S. investments?
Well, I don't think that's true for the big banks, but there may be small banks and credit unions. I don't know, but the point is, there may be financial institutions that would make it a point of servicing that market. This is all somewhat hypothetical. I appreciate that. But the difference between FATCA and the IGA is at least it puts the choice in the hands of the citizen, not in the hands of the banks. And so I don't understand how it can be said in light of that, that FATCA is worse than the IGA. I'm going to move to a bit of discussion of some of the legal argument that my friend made. First of all, Goodwin does not support her theory that the onus only shifts to the government to prove that the law is reasonable when there is a criminal or quasi-criminal law that's apparent by looking at the good one. Just pull up the right volume.
Sorry, where is the good one?
It's volume 8, tab 57. I think I only need to refer you to paragraph 60. Where the court says, the court has recognized from its earliest section 8 jurisprudence that the characterization of a search or seizure as either criminal or regulatory is relevant in assessing its reasonableness. And it does this in the context of having already established earlier, as I read to you, that where there is a warrantless seizure is presumptively unreasonable. And then the court said, here are all the factors that the government has to persuade the court to look at to demonstrate that the law is reasonable, and whether it's regulatory is a factor, as opposed to what my friend is suggesting, that if it's regulatory to start off with, the government has no onus. I think that's just completely, completely wrong. Ms. Nygaard refers to the guidelines that the CRA created for the banks as some evidence of oversight. That is not oversight. There are guidelines, they have no legal force. And likewise, my friend pointed to the fact that the CRA stamps the documents before they go over to the IRS as some kind of oversight. That's not oversight. That just tells the IRS that these documents are coming pursuant to the treaty, and perhaps tells other people, but it provides no oversight that provides protection to the Canadians, that the banks have done only that which they are allowed or required to do by law. The Chambre de Notaire case has no application to a case like this, where you're dealing with a mass seizure. I want to talk about section 15 for a moment.
Slow down, please.
My friend persists in suggesting that we can't get past the first test because the requirement that one be a that the U.S. law identifies U.S. persons for persons who are, in addition to being born in their country, or in addition to being a citizen. That just means that, and she contrasted that to the Martin case, where she says that that was about certain people being not included. So if section 15 from disability, she says it doesn't include every possible disability. The only difference between the Martin case and this case is Martin's a case of an under-inclusive scheme, but in this case it's an over-inclusive scheme. And that shouldn't matter for the purpose of Section 1, particularly since all of the section is designed to provide substantive equality. You asked whether or not, if birth or citizenship was at least a factor, wouldn't that be useful? And she said no. But my response is that it's not a factor. It's actually a determining, it's determinative as to whether or not tax is owed unless, you know, citizenship is somehow otherwise relinquished or renounced. Her interpretation of the needs, circumstances, and capacity test, I won't say anything other than that she didn't respond to the passages that I read and suggested that somehow they should that the court should continue to read those that factor in a way that goes to the relevance or justification of the law. I say she's just wrong. She didn't comment on whether the law was arbitrary because of the so-called accidental Americans, which I put quite a bit of emphasis on. She, in her response on the sovereignty point, she says, well, Parliament has already protected the sovereignty of Canadians because under the treaty, they won't allow the Americans to collect a tax debt against a citizen in Canada. Well, that's true, but the problem with the IGA is that the treaty protects citizens from collection efforts in Canada by the IRA. The IGA exposes a group of citizens not to collection efforts, but to enforcement efforts by the IRA, and thereby have denied them that protection of the Canadian sovereignty. And just a few more points, Justice McTavish, and I'll be done. On the Jarvis point, you recall Ms. Nygaard defended the conduct of CRA in continuing to use the data that was provided to the CRA under the IGA for domestic purposes, and she somehow likened that to what happened in Jarvis, where if the information that was collected properly under the audit provisions of Section 231, that information could then be used in a criminal investigation, because once it was properly collected, as the court said, under 231, the taxpayers had no reasonable expectation of privacy, and so there was nothing problematic of them using it in any criminal provision. But in our case, even if the information is collected by the CRA properly pursuant to the IGA, because it is being collected pursuant to the IGA for American purposes only, it doesn't follow from Jarvis that the CRA can turn around and then say that the Canadians have no reasonable expectation in privacy for the information to be used for domestic purposes, when it would be clear that the CRA could not have collected that information without a warrant. Another point that my friend emphasized a few times was that the information, this is on a different point, that the information that was collected on the IGA could not be used by the IRS for FBAR purposes. It is true that Canada will not enforce in Canada any attempt by the IRS to collect a penalty for FBAR violations. That Canada has made that decision, and that decision would seem to be something that Canadians and Canada could rely on based on the treaty, because you can only collect, Canada will only collect an American debt for taxes under the treaty, that's Article 26A. But Canada has no evidence in this case and is in no position to tell this court that the IRS, which administers FBAR, will not use information that is disclosed through the IGA for FBAR purposes, especially when the one important bit of information that is disclosed are account balances, which is tracks to what FBAR is all about. And I take you to the Blue Book, again, I think it's at tab 1, for the supplementary, type of supplementary authorities, in Canada, Section 241 requires that any information that is collected by the minister be private. But if I take you to the exceptions in Section 241, Mr. Benoz is looking for them, and there's very, very many. Start with 241 S. So I'm not sure I got the all the right subsections. I'm dealing with section 241 sub.
What page
are we on, Mr. Arve? Pardon me?
What page?
3007 on the bottom. And the marginal note says where taxpayer information may be disclosed. And there's many, many exceptions. But a couple to point out that kind of relate to something like FBAR is subsection S as in Sam on page 3014. provides provide taxpayer information solely for the purpose of ensuring compliance with Part 1 of the Proceeds of Crime and Terrorist Financing Act to an official of the Financial Transaction and Reports Analysis Center of Canada if the information can reasonably be considered to be relevant to a determination of whether a reporting entity has complied with the duty or obligation under Part 16. We know that the U.S. government could amend their legislation at any time, as can the Canadian government, notwithstanding there's a treaty. I don't think there can be any confidence that the IRS would not use if considered appropriate information for purposes of FBAR. Almost done. Just checking my notes. At one point, Ms. Nygaard referred to the evidence of Ms. Murray that it would be impossible to expect the CRA to do or insist that the Americans refine their sort of search criteria. And I don't want to hold up the report. I'm sorry, I don't have the reference. You'll recall, though, that Ms. Nygaard said it would have been impossible for the CRA to refine the search in some way. That was in response to, and Justice Martineau said something similar at Hillis. That was in response to our argument then that what the CRA should do is once it gathers all the information from the banks, it should, using sophisticated computers, which they all have, try to simply identify those Canadians, US persons, who fell into the gap, the treaty gap. That was that argument, and that was said to be impossible, and that's all that's in the record. That's different from what the argument I made before you, which is that if the IGA was truly concerned even with compliance and not just tax evasion, the request should have been limited to people whose income was below the threshold where in the United States that even requires a filing of a tax return.
So you're saying they should exclude those people?
Exclude those people. Or likewise, bank values less than $10,000, which then eliminated any concern about FBAR. Although, if Canada's saying that this isn't even about FBAR, then you have to wonder what the rationale of those thresholds are. Yes, I found the reference now. She was relying on the second Lurie affidavit at paragraph 18. And Justice Martineau and Hillis dealt with that at paragraph 74. Sorry, I didn't have that more handy. Ms. Nygaard said a number of times, she took you through the evidence, I forget which deponent was, for the proposition that Canada could have given the United States information about a person who was resident in Canada, a U.S. person resident in Canada, but she failed to point out any evidence that Canada had ever done so prior to the IGA. The most she could say was based on the wording of the treaty and what one of the deponents said, they could have, not that they ever did do. And there was some discussion about whether the banks do or don't disclose low value accounts. The interrogatory, which is found in the compendium of documents at tab 5, is interrogatory number 33. The answer is Canada does not know.
They have the discretion on that, is that right?
There was a question on that?
No, I'm saying banks have the discretion whether or not they...
Right, they have a discretion. And I think what this might be my last point. If you go to the compendium at tab 17,
Christensen?
Ms. Nygaard referred to this affidavit and relied on paragraph 14, which said, on April 19th, Pina Ferlisi Sartor replied and advised that TD had an obligation to identify any individuals who are U.S. persons under the CRA legislation, but that Vinnie's account would not be reported because the value of the account was under a certain dollar threshold, which was not specified. We have a couple points to make on this. My friends in the past have objected to information in our affidavits that are hearsay. We acknowledge that they were coming for the truth, and yet my friend seems to want to rely on this paragraph for the truth. Secondly, we don't know what the dollar threshold was in any event. And then, and if hearsay is going to be somehow permitted, then I ask you to go to tab 16, the affidavit of Ms. Sullivan, at paragraph 15A.
Paragraph what?
Paragraph 15, tab 16, paragraph 15A. And she said, in around November 14th, I spoke with an RBC employee named Risto regarding options with respect to my account. After several calls, I was advised of the following. Although the IGA allows for a reasonable explanation or a CLN to be provided as proof of non-U.S. citizenship. RBC policy is only to allow CLN as proof. One further point just occurred to me is that Ms. Nygaard referred to the voluntary amnesty program at some length yesterday. Mm-hmm. I'm told that they've now expired or are about to. I see my friend shaking her head.
Do we have any evidence?
She wants to correct me on the record. That's something I've just been told.
There's no evidence in the record of that?
No, I don't have that. And then we were advised yesterday of a new policy of the IRS, and I won't tell you it yet because I know my friend has an objection to me telling you. We just found out about this yesterday, and the IRS has agreed to, through proposed regulations, which are apparently effective now, to eliminate the withholding on payments of gross proceeds. Now, I don't pretend to understand the full implications of this policy. My friend Ms. Nygaard will say it has nothing to do with this case because it's somewhat premised on there being IGAs in many countries. The only reason I raise it now, it's obviously fresh evidence, is that it demonstrates at some level that the FATCA is not written in stone, and that if they're willing to make amendments to accommodate the banks in certain countries or to certain countries, then it may be something that the court can take notice of in light of the concern that the government's witnesses, which says that I can't imagine, one of them saying, I can't imagine that Canada could do persuade them to change anything. So I would like to provide the court with the information that I have. What I think my friend has a more official document, which she gave it to me but took it back. I have something that comes from a law firm that specializes in this matter.
Nygaard?
What I think Mr. Arbe has is a press release about press release. And I object to it on a number of bases. First of all, it's not proper evidence. Second of all, the date on it is December 13th, so if Mr. Arbe had wanted to bring this to the court's attention, it should have been done prior to the hearing so that we could address it more properly. Mr. Arbe is correct that I take the position that it's not relevant in any event. And if it was going to be introduced, there would have been other evidence we would have wanted to introduce into response to it, and to introduce it at this late date is just going to complicate matters unnecessarily. In as far as it's regarding a proposed regulation, not an actual regulation, and certainly we don't take the position that FATCA is carved in stone. We take the position that we have no control over FATCA, and it's what's there on the ground right now, and this regulation certainly doesn't propose to remove FATCA. It's a variation to one particular aspect of it.
This sounds like the thing that I raised right at the beginning of the hearing.
No, it's something different.
I
think what you raised right at the beginning of the hearing, now I may be confusing it, but I think that may have been to do with the doctor passive accounts, but maybe I'm wrong.
I thought we may have raised at the beginning of the hearing that there's a bill that somebody has sponsored to exempt countries like Canada from FATCA.
Yeah, a private, like equivalent of a private member's bill to exempt things. That was the one I thought you were raising as well.
That looks like what it is.
Which is something different once again, and also I would say irrelevant.
And the reason I didn't press that was because it is just what sounded like a private member's bill. But the reason why I think this is different is that this, again, the context may be very different from what we have here in Canada, but it shows that the, and even though it's a, hasn't been, the version that Ms. Agar has, it, I'm quite sure it says that it's, even though it hasn't been sort of enacted yet, it is considered by the IRS to be operative now. I think that's what it says. And my only point is that it goes to show that perhaps with the persuasion and rational conversations with countries in the United States and the IRS, it is going to be possible to persuade the IRS to make modifications to FATCA that would be consistent with Canadian constitutional requirements. That's it. I can't make it any higher or lower that. I just came upon this late yesterday. I mentioned it to my friend. Wasn't sure whether it was relevant. I thought it was of some relevance.
The only other thing I would add is it is just a proposed regulation. It is not law. And the IRS, if you're going to look at it, I'll give you the version we have. And it includes some commentary, including saying that this is being done because of the general compliance with FATCA. They don't feel that they perhaps need this particular part of it anymore.
Well,
so I don't think it's useful to you at all, because we're talking about not complying with FATCA.
Well, I'll take what both of you have and I'll look at it, but frankly, I mean, it sounds like I don't have enough background to know if we really give it any consideration, but you can hand it up and I'll take a look.
So this came off the IRS's website, and I've highlighted that portion I was just talking about. I think it's on page 9.
All right. Well, I have real concerns as to its probative value, but is that it, Mr.
Arming? That is it, except I'd like to just remind the court that when the Chief Justice, Lord Mansfield, decided the slavery case and he decided it lest the heavens fall, they didn't. The heavens didn't fall. And neither will they here if your justice, if you find in our favor. Those are my submissions.
Justice, I did have one matter on the part that I objected to not being proper reply that I just wanted to briefly respond to.
Okay, sorry, what was this now? Remind me.
So when Mr. Arve was telling you why FATCA wasn't worse, and I think I addressed in my main submissions most of what he said, and I'm not going to repeat that, but he took you to Mr. Wood's affidavit report, and if I heard him correctly, he said that this paragraph supported a proposition that accounts would not be closed. And in my submission, it in no way supports that. It talks about moving the withholding obligation from the foreign financial institution, so the Canadian financial institution, to the person paying the amount. That could be done.
I didn't quite understand that when I read it. Can you just repeat what you're saying or explain it?
So if that last sentence says the foreign financial institution is authorized by U.S. law to shift the withholding obligation to parties who transfer funds to recalcitrant account holders rather than being subject to the withholding obligation themselves. So what they can do is rather than the Canadian bank actually having to do the withholding on their customer, they can transfer that obligation to the entity from which the payment is coming. So administratively, they don't have to do the withholding it themselves necessarily. It doesn't say anything about them not having to close the account because it's a recalcitrant account holder. That is still going to have to happen. And if they can't close the account, we still have the problem of too many recalcitrant account holders making the institution non-compliant. And the broader implications have been flowed from that.
So that's not what Mr. Wood said, and there's no evidence to support what my friend said.
All right. Well, I'll read it and figure it out for myself.
Oh, I read what Mr. Wood says, that if you're recalcitrant, then we don't close your accounts, but rather we shift the withholding obligation to parties who have withdrawn the funds.
Well, Mr. Wood says what Mr. Wood says, and I'll read it and figure it out for myself. All right, well, thank you all very much. It's a very interesting case. It's also an extremely difficult case. It's going to take me a fair bit of time, obviously, to get a decision out. I will try to get to a decision as quickly as I can. I should also alert you to the fact that, having regard to the public interest in the case, I'm obliged under the Official Languages Act to have this decision translated in advance of it being released, which will add at least a month or 6 weeks to the reserve time. So it's going to be some considerable period of time before you get a decision, but I will try to get it to you as quickly as I can.
I should also say that my clients would request that the proceeding be archived if the court allows.
Oh, thank you for raising that. So they want it archived. Any objection?
No, my clients have been unable to watch any of it because the platform used is inaccessible to anyone in the federal government. So they'd probably like it archived in a way that maybe they can access it.
Okay. Well, that's fine then, if I can ask the registrar to communicate to whoever you need to communicate to so that that gets done. And thank you for reminding me about that. I completely forgot. All right. Well, thank you all very much. We are adjourned.
Order.
The special sitting of the federal court in Vancouver is now concluded.